Hello and welcome to a 2024 Jazz Journalists Association Book Awards author interview. I'm Brad Stone here with Carmen Fields, author of Going Back to T-Town, The Ernie Fields Territory Big Band. It's a book, it's one among six nominees of the in the category biography or autobiography, to be voted on by members of the Jazz Journalists Association, with winners to be announced on May 8th. Carmen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm overjoyed to be a part of it.
Well, it's an absolute delight to have you here. Congratulations on your nomination.
Isn't that cool? How cool is that?
We were talking before we started the interview, and I was telling you about how much I really enjoyed reading this book. I really did. I enjoyed your writing style. You're an excellent writer. For people who don't know, you've had a long, distinguished career as a journalist, and so you're an excellent writer. But also learning about your father and his band, and it's really an incredible piece of history that I'm glad that you brought to a broader audience and light. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. I'm more than gratified at the nomination and excited about it. And as they say with the Oscars, it's a pleasure and an honor to even be nominated and mentioned in the same sentence with those other five nominees. So I'm very pleased.
Well, and we had a particularly rich year last year of great books that came out. I mean, it was there were a lot of books that were, you know, considered. And so, you know, I think it's really quite an accomplishment for your nomination. Let's start to talk about, you know, your motivation, your impetus for writing this book. I think obviously one of the primary factors is, you know, kind of keeping or establishing maybe better the legacy of your father so that, you know, he isn't forgotten about. So maybe you can, you know, start with that and comment on that.
And that was a large part of my reason for doing the book was to preserve his legacy and to document the fact that he was a part of the earliest days of jazz, that whole era. And I also wanted to document and share his entrepreneurial spirit, because you didn't just get in a bus and carry these 17 musicians around the country and catch as catch can, but he was very deliberate in how he prepared his acts to please an audience, and was very deliberate in his own promotion that he did when he didn't have an agent, and was also always thinking of ways to keep his name out there, front and center, whether it's starting his own record company to do his recordings, or, as I mentioned, his own promotion. But I wanted to get that down. And finally, I wanted to bear witness, as he wanted me to the large number of musicians that cycled through his organization. Some became stars in their own right, others not as much, or became leaders of territory organizations, or became teachers and bus drivers and all manner of occupation. But he said, they must have been worth something, or I would not have had them in my band. So I wanted to bear witness to as many of those lives as possible as well.
Well, that's something that I really wanted to touch on in this interview, and we'll do so a little bit later. Some of these terrific players that were in his band, some very well known and some not so well known, right? But also, you know, with respect to his legacy, and, you know, posterity of his band, I think what, you know, what I was really reminded of in reading about your dad is is about sometimes, you know, history. This is something I've thought about, you know, more and more over the years, about how, you know, we repeat things and then it becomes the historical truth. You know, if something gets repeated off, you know, over and over and over again. So you pick up any sort of, you know, jazz history book, and it's one of the courses I teach. But you always, you know, when you talk about the big band era, what's the first thing that comes to mind, or what's the first thing you read about Count Basie? Mm-hmm. And rightfully so, right? I mean, you know, I'm not saying he doesn't deserve that, but what often gets forgotten about is all the other bands, because that was the thing then, right? And all these other terrific bands that kind of maybe get, you know, lost in the shuffle or lost in the retelling of the history. And so was that another thing that you were really kind of thinking about?
Indeed, because I had heard these stories over and over and more times than I would care to recount or remember. And by the time I started getting serious about preparing a book or a document, I wanted to some reassurance that those stories I had heard had some basis in truth. And so that led to a wider research of old newspapers for either reviews or for ads that were placed saying that he was in different cities. And it was also important to me, I have to give credit to the University of Oklahoma Press for being willing to take on this story. And that gave a certain, an academic press gave it a certain legitimacy, because they had editors cross-checking and checking my sightings and citations and sending me back to find exactly where I quoted something and give them so they could find it. But that was very important to make it more than just my father sitting me down and spinning some tales about life on the road, but that there had some basis of truth in it.
Yeah, your book does seem, you know, very, very well researched. And so that definitely comes through. And then I wrote down, you know, a third factor that might have been, you know, something that was, you know, another motivation for you. And just, you know, documenting what a terrific person he seemed to be. Mm-hmm. You know, just seemed to be a really good guy, a good, you know, decent human being, and cared about his band members and you know, put them first. And so that really came through as well.
He did. He was a very caring man and took seriously his responsibility. He often had to, before hiring someone, go and talk to their parents to get permission and let them know the kind of person he was that they were entrusting their son or daughter to. And that was very important to him. And I wanted to demonstrate what a family man he was, because he and my mother were married for over 60 years before he died. And he always gave her credit for allowing him, without complaint, to enjoy the occupation of his choosing, which required him to be away from home for long periods of time sometime. But she accepted that. She said he had that horn in his mouth when she met him, and she would never tell him to put it down.
Well, that, you know, that really came through, you know, early on in the book when he took the band to New York, and your mom said, "You go. You know, you go do your thing." And she was obviously, you know, very, very supportive. So that's an incredible tale unto itself, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You saw the letters that he wrote back to her. I quoted some of them, but it was amazing to me some of the others that didn't make it, where he was encouraging her. "Well, I haven't heard from you in a few days." And as it turns out, my mother is one of few words. And when I was in college, I would get a note on the inside of a gum wrapper or on an index card. She was just not a writer. Okay. she didn't do that. And I, when I was reading through the letters that she shared with me, I said, Mama, he's begging you to write to him even then. What's the deal on you? That was her way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a remarkable story. And, you know, when he had met John Hammond and then subsequently took the band or most of the band to New York, and really gave that a go. And then ultimately decided for various reasons to, you know, return to Oklahoma. How much do you think over the years he kind of regretted maybe not staying in New York longer so that maybe, you know, the big break, so to speak, would have come along?
I think he second-guessed that decision many times. And I think one of the letters to me that I quote in the book, he said he thought that things would happen after 2 or 3 months. And when they didn't, he came back to Oklahoma to my mother and my brother at the time. And so I sensed, although he did not specifically say that, that there was a hint of regret at that. The other things that he was very definitive about having regret, he wanted, like anything, to have a national radio hookup. And one had been promised to him. He was next in line after Chick Webb at, I think it was the Savoy Theater or Savoy Ballroom. But Chick Webb died. And the promoters decided, since Ella Fitzgerald was going to be the leader, in order to kind of introduce her to the public, that radio spot that he was designated for went to her as the new leader. And that opportunity did not surface again. He also had a regret of not having an international tour from the State Department, much like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong had enjoyed at that time. And he had high hopes when he was very close to the former U.S. Senator from Oklahoma, Fred Harris. But that never materialized. So it was a disappointment that I identified about that, and a regret, but not an anger or bitterness that somebody else got it and I didn't. There was never a hint of that in his life that I was able to witness.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, and it's been a few months since I read your book, but it was that instance of Chick Webb passing away and then Ella getting the spot for the radio program that was kind of a deciding factor for him to move the band back, right?
Mm-hmm. I would say so. It's hard to pinpoint a timeline on those things so long ago, but he would often say, well, that's my feathers fell in connection with that. But I'm sure that was a major factor. And because the promoter, Willard Alexander, the dates were getting a little skimpier. And so the members of the band were kind of worried. Daddy was had a little more faith, but you have those people whispering in his ear or complaining, well, hey, we were working more regular when we were in Oklahoma. We can do this. Let's go back. So those were some of the factors as well.
Yeah, and I think that band members and clearly your dad wanted to get back to his family.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
But Count Basie advised him to stick it out a little longer. They were very close friends and traded musicians back and forth from their organizations. But in the end, he did want to get back to his family and wanted to be assured of some steadier work.
I thought it was really interesting that they were, you know, your dad and Count Basie were good friends, and that they traded notes about players in their bands. I thought that was really a fascinating insight. And then he, you know, of course, knew Dizzy as well, right?
Yes, yes. His principal vocalist, Melvin Moore, went to Dizzy's organization when he left Ernie Fields. And they became, kindred spirits, so to speak, or acquaintances, yes.
One of the things that, you know, I got interested in, you know, after reading your book is as a radio guy, I was looking for music, and there's just not that much available of recorded music. There are some, of course, that may be a factor as well in terms of, you know, your dad not being as well known as Count Basie, for instance. Are there any recordings that in existence that might come to light someday?
I know he pops up from time to time in some of the compilations that are out there in the public domain. A professor, I was at the Jazz Educators Convention in 2003, and one of the professors came up to me and showed me, says he has a course on Kansas City jazz, and he features two of my father's earliest recordings, T-Town Blues and another one, and showed me the compilation that he got it from. But I'm not aware of what's out there and what's not. I think the later recordings from the In the Mood era, the late 50s, early 60s, those from Capitol Records, those keep popping up from time to time. But some of the things he recorded on his own label, Frisco Records, and then some of the things on the Gotham label, those are old 78s. I don't know where they are, who has those masters, what happened to them. So they may occur at some point, be back out there. And may not, but they're very few. And again, he wasn't as prolific as Count Basie, even in the early days, or a Duke Ellington. And I am not meaning to infer that he had the same stature as they did or was nearly as prolific. But I wanted noted for the record, he was there.
Well, here's to hoping that those master tapes surface someday.
Wouldn't that be grand?
That would be awesome, especially with today's technology in terms of remastering and
yes.
Can really make things sound vibrant. I promised that we were going to talk a little bit about some of the musicians in his band, and I was going through at the end of your book, you have a list of. A comprehensive list, I might add, as best as you could do, of all the players that were in his band, and I'm sure that took a considerable amount of time on your part to research. But I just want to mention three names that I was like, wow, Booker Ervin, J.J. Johnson, and Gene Ammons. Wow.
And he said that he believed that Booker Ervin was probably the best instrumentalist to come through his organization. He had enormous respect for him. And J.J. Johnson was a discovery for me. I knew of his reputation, but I had no idea that he had been in my father's band until I started the research. And, lines like that made me gain an even greater respect for my father professionally. I always had the love and affection for him, but that gave me a greater appreciation for the caliber of musicians that he scouted and hired.
And I think that there are a lot of other players in his band who are obviously, very gifted that maybe are not the household names that the three that I mentioned are,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Comes to mind Andre Lewis, who was a keyboardist and is credited with impact around electronic music. And ironically, his father, Harry Lewis, had been a part of Dad's band some 20 or 30 years before little Andre comes along. And Leroy Cooper, the mainstay with Ray Charles's orchestra as well. So, there are some giants, and then there are some middlers, I guess you could call them, and then there are some completely unknowns. But as he said, they must have been worth something or he would not have hired them.
One that came to mind, Hobart Banks, who, your dad spoke very highly about his piano playing and how he didn't want to go to New York. He wanted to stay with his family. And those kind of decisions, can be the types of things that, might, make it or break it in terms of, popularity or notoriety in terms of people knowing them. I think that, there's a lot of terrific musicians out there that just never really get known as a household name.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Carmen, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you and get to meet you sort of in person, as we were talking about before. I hope that I get to meet you in person someday. Soon, and we can chat further. I want to give you an opportunity to, put in any last words.
Well, I think what was particularly stunning was how my father navigated Jim Crow and the inconveniences of racial segregation during that time, and to still maintain dignity and a presence through all of that. And thankfully, he, for the most part, escaped right danger in terms of injury. But navigating where you're going to eat, if you can use the restroom, where you get the services was more than a notion. And that recalled a time that many of us prefer to forget, but that was real. And he rose above that and accomplished in spite of those inconveniences.
Well, I think that we'd prefer that it hadn't existed, but I think it's important that we remember it. And I think it must have been incredibly difficult for him. It's hard enough taking a band of that size on the road with all the logistics. And then to have to encounter those sorts of obstacles, and then to do it with such dignity, I think is a real feather in his cap. And thank you for bringing that to light.
Thank you.
We've been joined by Carmen Fields, author of Going Back to T-Town, the Ernie Fields Territory Big Band. It's a nominee for Book of the Year, to be voted on by members of the Jazz Journalists Association. You can see the winners at www.jjajazzawards.org on May 8th and after. And hear other interviews with nominated authors on other episodes of The Buzz. So you've been listening to The Buzz, the podcast of the Jazz Journalists Association. This edition has been edited by Wiz Petta, with John Michael's composition, Big Vic, as our theme music. I'm Brad Stone. Check back for more of The Buzz.